WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In this, our next to the last show of 2010, we're going to look back on the year in film and pop. Our rock critic Ken Tucker will be here with his 10 best list later in the show. Up first, our film critic David Edelstein. David, good to have you back on the show. So let's get right to it. I'm going to ask you to read your 10 best list. You want to start with number 10 and work your way to the top film of the year?
Sure, except as usual, Terry, I don't have 10, I have 12. The reason I have 12 is because I just kept adding things and didn't, as I saw them, and didn't want to take other things out. I thought, why punish things that I love just because I saw something that I also loved?
The answer would be because 10 means 10, but go ahead, we'll let you take that liberty.
Well, let me start then working backwards. I'll start with Blue Valentine, which of course is this psychodrama with Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams. Then I have Despicable Me, that wonderful Scrooge-like supervillain animated movie. Then a documentary a lot of people don't know called Marwin Call. Then Banksy's documentary, the nefarious, infamous graffiti artist documentary Exit Through the Gift Shop, which may or may not be a prank, but is great in any case. Then an Italian movie I think is a masterpiece called Vincere. It means win in Italian, and it's about Mussolini and his bride, his first wife. Then the film Mother and Child, Rodrigo Garcia's film with Annette Bening and Naomi Watts. Mike Leigh's film Another Year comes in the next place, and that opens very late this month. Toy Story 3, of course. I think that's a movie that many of us agree on. Please Give, Nicole Holofcener's great comedy, starring Catherine Keener. I have a tie between two documentaries that touch on the global financial crisis in very different ways. Client 9, The Rise and Fall of Elliot Spitzer, and Inside Job. Finally, my best film of the year is Winter's Bone, Deborah Granik's harshly beautiful adaptation of Daniel Woodrell's Ozark noir novel.
So how did a little independent film like Winter's Bone end up topping your list?
Well, it's funny. I've been reading Daniel Woodrell's books for several years. He wrote the book Woe to Live On, which became the Ang Lee film Ride with the Devil. And it was about William Quantrell and the massacres done by Confederate soldiers in 1863 in the South. And ever since then, I thought, wow, you know, this guy sort of does what Cormac McCarthy does, you know, without a lot of the fuss and the pseudo-biblical language. And Winter's Bone is really his greatest novel. And when I went to see the movie, I thought, Deborah Granik, you know, not just got it right, but she deepened it. This is a film that could so easily be this dreary, depressing, regional, realistic kind of movie. And instead, she pushes it to the point where it achieves kind of a mythical intensity. I think it's a gorgeous, beautiful movie. And I don't understand why there are a lot of people who say, oh, it's so depressing. I thought it was an absolutely exhilarating movie, managing to be so hopeful in the midst of such horror.
So you are out of step with your own New York Film Critics Circle, which selected The Social Network as the top film of the year, as did the LA Film Critics. So I'm not saying it does belong on the 10 best list, but tell us why it's not on yours.
Yeah, I was sitting in the New York Film Critics Circle meeting, and it was on ballot after ballot after ballot, and I was getting this sinking feeling because I really wanted Winter's Bone to win. And it's going to win all the big critics' prizes, and it might win the Oscar. You know, it's going head-to-head with The King's Speech, I think. And I don't dislike The Social Network. I actually do like it. But I also think it's an enormously glib and cynical film about the impulses underlying our new way of life. While at the same time, I think it also appeals to this pervasive 21st century fantasy of wanting to be a billionaire. It's a good business saga, but I'm mystified by how many people seem to think it's this groundbreaking movie about a turning point in American culture.
You know, it's funny, the only two real commercial films in your top 10 or 12 or Despicable Me and Toy Story 3, both animated films. Most of the films are either documentaries or independent films on your list.
Yeah, and it's funny, too. By the way, I like being entertained as much as the next person. I just can't get worked up over any mainstream film this year, with the exception of Toy Story 3 and Despicable Me, though I think Winter's Bone had every potential to cross over. The thing I want to say about Toy Story 3, though, is people were in tears, we know, but I don't know about you. I was crying. You know, people around me were crying. Although it is, a great comedy, underneath it, it really is a story about death, about getting old, about losing your usefulness. And it has this weird, almost, I don't want to sound too pretentious, I already do, but this almost Buddhist quality about investing these toys with spiritual properties and, you know, our deepest childhood feelings, and then what it means to cast them away or forget about them. Toy Story is very into sort of resurrecting those feelings that we had, you know, when our world was just kind of coming together, and that we've either repressed or we've suppressed. So it's not just shallow escapism. You can talk about Toy Story 3 probably more than you can talk about a lot of the art films on my list.
Were there any performers or directors who you feel came into their own this year? Either first-time directors or actors or people who'd been around before? It wasn't until this year that you really saw what they could do.
Jim Carrey plays a gay con man in a film that's out now called I Love You, Philip Morris. And it's interesting to me because if you watch, have followed Jim Carrey over the years, he's always struck me as the kind of least psychologically filled in of modern clowns. There's something very desperate about him, as if he stopped doing his shtick on camera, that he would dissolve in front of your eyes. And playing a gay character, playing a closeted gay character, that desperation takes on astonishing emotional resonance when he's forced to live in a homophobic culture and to kind of parody normality. There's all this subterfuge and compartmentalization. They become second nature. And it turns out to be a perfect vehicle for his peculiar persona. I don't think the movie is quite a success, but the performance cuts very, very deep. I think it's probably the best male performance of the year. And I know he's, you know, doesn't have a chance at winning an Academy Award or a Critics Award this year, because Colin Firth is winning everything. And we know that Colin Firth gave the best performance of last year in A Single Man, for which he was pushed aside for Jeff Bridges. And now he's going to win everything for King's Speech, in which he's wonderful. But I think it's a little bit more gimmicky a performance than his extraordinary turn in A Single Man. The other performances, well, Annette Bening just continues to shock me with this kind of thing that she does that nobody else does. She plays people playing people. She plays people who in life are performing, who are putting on this mask and playing these roles, and then kind of specializes in showing you how the mask is constantly dissolving and then being put back on and then dissolving. And she's amazing in Mother and Child, Rodrigo Garcia's movie that is on my 10 best list that was an utter flop. She's going to win all the awards for The Kids Are All Right, in which she's wonderful, too. So that's an amazing performance. Patricia Clarkson in Cairo Time. Patricia Clarkson is a great clown. Who knew she could give a performance as a woman having a kind of quiet epiphany on a trip to Egypt, in which she's mostly alone? Amy Adams in The Fighter is wonderful. Kirsten Dunst is completely surprising in All Good Things. She gives a really mature and scarily good performance.
So, David, we've talked about some of your favorite films of the year. What are some of your least favorite, some of the films that you think are the worst of the year?
Well, there have been some extraordinarily bad films this year. On our screens right now, you can subject yourself or preferably someone you loathe to Tron Legacy, which looks like Disco Night at the Hyalife Ronton, and I'm convinced has given me a brain tumor. The Nutcracker in 3D, oh, it's the Nutcracker stripped of dance and turned into this allegory of fascism. And some of the music, the Tchaikovsky music, is given lyrics, like Waltz of the Sugar Plum Fairies has two songs with that tune. And I'm telling you, there are few things less suited to having lyrics than it is not a tune that you can sing very well in a way that works with any sort of word. That's about how good Nathan Lane sounds in the movie. Even if it were well done, which it isn't, it would still be a terrible movie.
Do you have any good suggestions for movies to see over the holidays?
Everybody is asking me, why would the Joel and Ethan Coen remake True Grit? Wasn't it good enough the first time? How can anybody top John Wayne? And it's true that John Wayne was a terrific Rooster Cogburn, but evidently the Coens had some connection with the book by Charles Portis that the Henry Hathaway film didn't quite touch. It's written in this sort of quasi-biblical dialect that is very perverse, and because it's full of all this ghoulish imagery and killing and cynicism and nihilism, and obviously that's the Coens' bread and butter, and they've made an extraordinarily beautiful-looking film, very austere, but with these gonzo, over-the-top performances. It's like Jeff Bridges is no rival to John Wayne, but he's hilarious, even though you can barely understand what he's saying because he's often so drunk he can barely get the words out. And I've seen the movie twice. I was very disappointed the first time. The second time, I was actually very charmed by it. So I think if you lower your expectations, you'll have a great time.
As usual, there's a couple of films on your best of list that haven't opened nationally yet, so most of our listeners won't have had a chance to see these films. So you should tell us a bit about Blue Valentine.
Well, Blue Valentine is an extraordinarily intimate psychodrama. It stars Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams, and it's in two parts. It flashes back and forth between their kind of nutty courtship and their tortured dissolution. It's all handheld camera in very close to the actors, and you might come out hating it, or you might be just utterly enthralled at how intimate its portrait of a, you know, gradually dissolving relationship. It's already well known because it was slapped with an NC-17 rating by the MPAA, which Harvey Weinstein of the Weinstein Company appealed and appealed and appealed, and he finally got an R. And when you see the movie, it's nothing. It's a sex act, but it's not even completed. And compared to the things that the MPAA gives PG-13 to, these splattery movies in which people are incinerated in front of your eyes, you just can't believe that a little bit of sex is going to make them say, oh, no, kids can't possibly see it. The other film is Another Year, and anybody who knows Mike Leigh knows the way he works giving actors their parts and sending them out into the world and having them collect all kinds of data. And this is about a particular couple played by Jim Broadbent and Ruth Sheen, who are these kind of earth mother and earth father to a group of very, very lonely people who converge and complain. And it's another one of these movies that at times makes you want to jump off a bridge, but, you know, most of the time want to rescue somebody who's about to jump off a bridge and give them a big hug. So I couldn't recommend it more.
Well, David, I hope you get to see some great movies in 2011.
I know I will, because there are about 600 movies that open every year, and the odds are one of them's going to be good.
And you'll keep going until you find it.
I'm tireless.
All right. Well, I wish you happy holidays.
Thank you so much, Terry. It's always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure, and thanks so much for talking with us. David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can see his complete Best of the Year list, along with links to his reviews of those films, on our website, freshair.npr.org.